Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Strong arms tactics. Under pressure from Canada's allies, Defence Minister Bill Blair tells us the government is boosting the country's military budget, just not quite as much as other countries might have hoped.
Off with their headlines. After 124 years, the White Horse Star newspaper announces it's shutting down. Its longtime editor tells us the writing was on the wall.
Door crasher deal. Mexico-Ecuador relations are splintered, to say the least, after police storm the Mexican embassy in Quito and drag out the former vice president who was seeking asylum.
It takes all kindnesses. As Eid approaches, we'll bring you a short story that captures the generosity and hope of the season and the message that no good deed goes unrewarded.
Warning, graphic language, like the eclipse, it may be unwise to look directly at the image recently posted by the UK Conservative Party.
And they did a lot of laughing, but it was dark humor. A small community in Newfoundland planned a big eclipse party near a small island. The organizer tells us about getting people together to celebrate Eclipse Island style. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that never forgets the sunblock. The Trudeau government is promising to crank up military spending, but not all at once and not by as much as our allies might hope. Minister of National Defence Bill Blair announced the new money today as he rolled out the results of a long-awaited review of Canada's defence priorities. It aims to prepare the country for the challenges of a changing world with the help of an $8 billion spending boost. But that boost is going to be spread over the next 5 years, with most of it coming after the next election. And it still won't bring Canada up to NATO's minimum standard of spending 2% of gross domestic product on defence. We reached Defence Minister Bill Blair in Ottawa.
Minister Blair, there are certainly a lot of promises in this new policy, but it is still falling short of NATO's 2% benchmark, the target there. Why?
Neil, first of all, I think it's a very significant new investment in defense spending. And as a policy document, I think it provides clarity to the members of Canadian Armed Forces, to Canadians, to our allies, to Canadian industry about the investments we're making in defense. It is very, very, very significant, and I think it does start to address some of the, I think, capability shortfalls that the Canadian Armed Forces has been experiencing. I think it is a recognition of a new focus in Canada's defense policy on our far north and Arctic security. And I would hope that Canadians reading that document would also see that a lot of the work, first of all, there's very significant new investments in defense. But in addition to that, there is foundational work that is necessary and going to continue to take place because we need to create additional capabilities that are not included in this document. Things like, for example, underwater surveillance and renewal and replacement of our submarine fleet for air missile defense systems that we're going to be building in the north. I think we're on a very clear upward trajectory in our spending. And as I've been able to assure our allies that we're making those investments.
When might we see us hit the 2%?
Well, again, I think the clear trajectory we're on will take us through the next, through 2029, up to 1.76%. And by the way, just to be really clear, since 2014, which was the previous government's last defense budget, we will have increased defense spending, almost tripling it over that period of time. It's a very significant new investment in Canadian tax dollars into defense spending.
The conservative the conservative defense critic James Bazin, is, as you may have seen, says the prime minister is, quote, once again kicking the can down the road by committing most of the defense spending in today's announcement until after the next election, end quote.
I'd have to compliment him for being able to say that to you with a straight face. Because when he was in government and when the conservatives were in charge, they actually reduced in 2013 the defense spending to 1%. And in 2014, they actually fell below 1%. In Canadian history, the lowest investment in defense. Since that time, we have been, as I said, increased defense spending by almost 70%. And with the document we produced today, it will actually result in a near tripling of our defense spending. And in every one of those measures, Mr. Bazin has voted against them. And so when he says that, I think it's disingenuous at best. But I would point out, we have been making very significant new investments in defense capability, and with the announcement today, we're going even further.
And frankly, the
disparaging comments of people who only criticize, they don't contribute.
Recruitment is a big part of this document, and I'm wondering, Minister, what your message is to potential recruits who have reconsidered maybe and are not signing up because of all of the stories about misconduct allegations, but even more recently, just cost of living issues. You know, the Canadian press wrote about the military chaplains saying morale among troops. This is just back in October of last year, saying morale among troops is the lowest it's been in recent memory as many soldiers struggle with the cost of living. So what is your message to those potential recruits?
My message, first of all, to the members of the Canadian Armed Forces, we've heard you. We are investing in housing on the Canadian Forces bases. We're investing in childcare. We're investing in family health services. We've just recently negotiated and given a pretty significant pay raise to members of the Canadian Armed Forces. By the way, Mr. Bazin voted against that, but that's a different issue. But we are investing in them. We've heard them. Solving the recruitment problem, I think there are still very many Canadians who, given an opportunity to serve in the Canadian Armed Forces, will find an extraordinary career and an opportunity to serve their country. And so we're looking at all of our recruitment processes and our onboarding processes to make it easier for them to join. And at the same time, we are investing in their facilities, their infrastructure, the equipment they're going to use, their training, and their deployments. And I believe that there are many, many new opportunities that we're creating for members of the Canadian Armed Forces. And I would encourage Canadians and permanent residents right across this country to consider the new opportunities that a career in the Canadian Armed Forces will present to them. I think there's extraordinary opportunities to serve. There's no higher calling for any Canadian than service to their country, and this is an extraordinary opportunity for them to do that. We're taking the steps necessary, and we're making the investments that previous governments have failed to make.
Before we let you go, Minister, peacekeeping is something Canadians, many Canadians, deeply, you know, associate this country with. It's part of this country's identity. There isn't a lot of discussion about peacekeeping in this particular document. I'm thinking of, obviously, Russia and Ukraine, Gaza and Israel, a Rafah invasion potentially imminent, according to Israeli officials. When they don't see peacekeeping heavily in this document, what should that tell Canadians about the way this government sees Canada's role in the world in the future?
Well, first of all, Canada has a long and proud history of peacekeeping, and the peacekeeping initiative at the UN was actually started by Mike Pearson, a Canadian. And we have a long history, and I think a very proud one, of Canadian service in peacekeeping. But this document also recognizes that the nature of the threat environment is changing quite significantly. And the best way that this document identifies to preserve peace is through deterrence and strength. And so we are investing, first of all, in our own defense, and that's why it's our North, strong and free. We're also investing in capabilities not to fight a war, but to prevent a war. Production is deterrence. Preparation is deterrence. And we're making those investments. We are the only ones with responsibility for the defense of Canada, and we're stepping up to make sure that we have the capability to defend Canada. And as we become strong at home, that enables us to be strong for our allies and our global partners around the world. I think, as the Prime Minister said today, the world needs more Canadian involvement. And so we're investing in the Canadian Armed Forces. We're investing in our foreign policy and all of the work that Canada does to support global peace around the world. But we do that by being strong at home.
Minister Blair, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Of course. Thanks very much.
Bill Blair is Canada's Minister of National Defense. Some Mexican diplomats should be in Quito, Ecuador today. Instead, they're back in Mexico after police broke into the Mexican embassy in Quito on Friday night. Former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass should be at the embassy too, but he was taken away during that raid despite having been granted political asylum by Mexico. Mexican consul Roberto Canseco tried to stop the vans from leaving, but he was wrestled to the ground by police. Later, he spoke to reporters and was asked how criminals were able to raid the embassy.
Esto no es posible. No puede ser. Es una locura. Estoy muy preocupado porque pueden matarlo. No hay ningún fundamento para hacer esto.
¿Hubo un aviso previo?
No.
Que esto pueda pasar.
Esto es totalmente fuera de toda norma.
This is not possible. It can't be. It's madness, he says. Mr. Canseco goes on to raise concerns that Mr. Glass could be killed. Maria Dolores Mino is the director of Ecuador's Independent Law and Justice Observatory and a professor of international law. We reached her in Quito.
Maria, you can certainly hear the anguish in Consul General Canseco's voice as he says this is outside every norm. You don't have to be a diplomat to know that. What about for you? What was it like when you learned what had happened?
So you could feel the tension between Ecuador and Mexico, but nobody really thought it would amount to this. So I think it was really shocking for everybody because, as you said, you really don't need to be an expert on international law to know that embassies are not to be entered by force by the state or the authorities of that state. And what was more shocking was long silence from Ecuadorian authorities. And then when they actually started speaking about what had happened, they couldn't really justify because you cannot do it under international law.
Let's go back for our listeners who may just be getting up to speed on all of this and starting with that extraordinary moment. But why was Jorge Glass at the Mexican embassy in the first place?
Former Vice President Glass has been prosecuted and sentenced for several cases regarding high corruption. So recently, another case was opened against him, and local authorities requested that he was detained. And so he appeared at the embassy. We don't know how he got there. Mm-hmm. And he requested what's called diplomatic asylum. He claims that he is subject to political persecution due to the fact that he is one of the highest authorities of the Correa government. So that's his claim.
He's been there, though, since late December. So that escalation that surprised you and so many others, what triggered that escalation and that raid on Friday night?
Another thing that's important before I answer your question is that a lot of former high authorities from the Correa government have sought political asylum. Mm-hmm. And the common ground would be that they are all accused of crimes of high corruption. So I think it all started with President López Obrador from Mexico giving really inappropriate statements, I would say. Elections were held in Ecuador last year, presidential elections. And Fernando Villavicencio, who was a well-known whistleblower and former congressman, was running for election. And so 2 days before the debate, he was murdered, sicariato style. And a lot of people believe Correa and his people are involved in that assassination, but that has not been confirmed. So it was a very shocking episode for Ecuador. Ecuador is still very scared because of that assassination. So it was, I think, very responsible for President López Obrador to just start talking about such a delicate issue.
You're saying that the statements helped trigger what happened?
I think so. I think so. And what happened next is that we started hearing rumors about Mexico granting definitely political asylum to former Vice President Glass. Mm-hmm. So what local authorities are saying now is that they had inside information that Glass was going to flee the country.
Ecuador's foreign minister, Gabriela Sommerfeld, in response to all of this, has said the decision to enter the embassy factored in the fact that he was, in their view, an imminent flight risk, and said that they had exhausted all avenues for diplomatic dialogue with Mexico at that point. And she said it is not legal to grant asylum to people convicted of common crimes and by competent courts, end quote. This has caused such international shock and condemnation. Is what the foreign minister said going to actually sway opinion on that?
The thing is that the institution of political asylum is highly controversial per se. So I understand that First Minister Sommerfeld can say that Mexico was actually violating the Caracas Convention by granting asylum to someone that's a common criminal. That's the excuse. But even if we accept that statement, it's already a moot point because nothing in that situation waives Ecuador from its international obligation to respect the territory of foreign embassy. So the discussion now, I think it's other.
We know Mexico is planning to challenge this raid at The Hague. What does it say to you, though, about where Ecuador is right now, that for whatever reason they would take such extraordinary measures?
I do believe that Mexico is entitled to present a claim before the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Ecuador should have done the same thing before this whole thing blew up. Ecuador chose the violent way, I would say, that kind of plays the country as the villain in this story. Politics in Ecuador have been divided between those who support former President Correa and everybody else who doesn't. And this has escalated to a very violent state of political polarization, I would say, in which every important decision that's taken in the country is analyzed through the lens of either you are with Correa or you are against Correa. And so most people don't understand like the international impact of this decision and how it will impact Ecuador in its foreign relations. Most people, honestly, are satisfied with the fact that even by violating international law, Jorge Glass was detained. So inside Ecuador, the measure is highly applauded.
Maria, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
Maria Dolores Mino is the director of Ecuador's Independent Law and Justice Observatory and an international law professor at the International University of Ecuador. We reached her in Quito. In 1766, British explorer James Cook witnessed an eclipse on a small island off the southern coast of Newfoundland, and he used it to calculate the longitude of the site, which was not easy to do back then. So he named the island after the natural wonder that had helped him make his calculations. Today, just across the water from Eclipse Island, Michael Ward celebrated the eclipse, along with hundreds of others. We reached him in Burgio, Newfoundland and Labrador.
Michael, I've been in the studio all afternoon. What was it like to see the eclipse unfold?
It was an amazing experience. We were down on the government wharf. Department of Transportation was gracious enough to let us do our little community event down there. We had the Burgio First Nations was down there. For lack of a better word, the opening act. doing a drumming circle. A number of songs and doing a smudging, amazing experience. The community gathering. We had bought probably about 490 pairs of eclipse glasses for a community of about 1,100 people.
And you said if you gave all of them out, you would be pleased. Did you?
And they are gone.
Nice. Victory. Just victory. On that alone, victory. But did the weather work out? Were you able to see things clearly?
We couldn't have asked for any better. It was, my wife was just kind of saying earlier on that, it was beautiful during the lead up to the eclipse. It was, and of course, clear sky during the eclipse. And as the eclipse was over and people were starting to move on, a little layer of clouds kind of passed mm-hmm. over the sun, and just the way that looked, that was amazing as well.
How many people made it onto the island?
We weren't on Eclipse Island. You know, Eclipse Island is kind of about, I'd say about 200 feet off of the government wharf. But we had, it's tiny, and plus, it is Newfoundland in April. the waters are going to be cold. And
there are logistics to factor in, yeah.
Exactly. But we probably had about 200, 250 people down on the wharf.
Yeah. Had you witnessed any kind of eclipse? I mean, this one's special, obviously, but had you ever experienced anything like this?
I grew up in Lab City back mm-hmm. in the 70s, and I remember there was an eclipse there. And this time it was probably an even better experience because, being able to get out there, and not just the experience of the eclipse, but just the community aspect of it, being surrounded by all those people, all there for that one thing.
Yeah, you're probably a pretty tight-knit community. I mean, I don't want to take liberties, but just I'll go out on a limb and say you're probably pretty close-knit there. What does something like this bring to an already close-knit place?
We are where we are, and we are what we are, and it's a small community. Our major industry, being kind of the public sector. So anytime, we can, kick off, tourism early, it's always good.
Our producers looked up the next time a total eclipse is set to be seen in the skies above Canada. Eclipse Island isn't in the path of totality, apparently. Do you think you'll do something special anyway?
We'll have to move Eclipse Islands. It's one of those things that, we're actually starting to shift our marketing focus and with Eclipse Island and kind of incorporating some of that stuff there, going forward.
What does that marketing look like? I mean, are you selling, what do you sell on Eclipse Island for tourists besides the beauty?
The beauty of it at this point, we don't, it's not like we've got souvenirs, but it's one of those things kind of kicking it around. It is, mainly a fishing community, but, we do have, we are working on a major project here with the, trying to set up the waters around Burgio as a National Marine Conservation Area and redesignating the provincial park here as a national park. And this is one of the kind of those aspects that we're trying to pick out to say, okay, here's Eclipse Island. Let's get some marketing focus on this to be able to say, okay, come see where Captain Cook was, when he was making all these, these measurements and things like that, and being able to use that and the whole historical aspect of it.
Michael, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
Michael Ward is the town clerk manager for Burgio, Newfoundland and Labrador. So I've been working on a new theme maybe for the show. It's something that today's youth will really find gnarly and radical. That's youth slang. Personally, I do think this song is kind of a boomer. I mean, it's a banger. So let's check it out.
The second best radio show in the world.
I feel like maybe I was trying to do too much. It was a bit chaotic. Also, I don't remember putting so many boings in there. Now I know how the person who designed the British Conservative Party's social media post feels. Late last week on X, the party posted, "Don't let the doomsters and the naysayers trick you into talking down our country. The UK is as strong as ever." And beneath that message was a breathtaking graphic. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, an Aston Martin car, the British men's soccer team, fighter planes, King Charles, a big ship, director Christopher Nolan, more fighter planes. And across the top, the message, "Britain is the second most powerful country in the world." Sorry to shout, but for some reason, "in the world" is in about 72-point font, and "Britain is the second most powerful country" is in like 12-point font. That is one of many odd design choices. Well, it's one of all odd design choices. Why are the soccer players just posing for a photo instead of playing? Is that a flapping flag hidden behind the words or just some swirly lines? Why do all the images look like they were cut out of a magazine so the whole thing looks like a ransom note? And should the king be on there? Well, no, he should not. One is not supposed to implicate the royals in common politics. That may be why the Conservative Party took the image down, or that might be because everyone made fun of it. Look, maybe Tory officials looked at their disastrous poll numbers and the widely mocked image and thought, this is not a pretty picture.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
For 124 years, the White Horse Star newspaper has published more than 40 pages of local and international news at least 3 times a week. But now the Star is winking out. On Friday, the owners announced that they will be shutting the paper down after years of financial hardship and a failed last-ditch effort to sell. Jim Butler has worked at the White Horse Star for 43 years. He's been its editor for 36. We reached him in Whitehorse, Yukon.
Jim, 43 years is certainly a long time to be in any job. This one was a passion project for you. Can you at this point even imagine working anywhere else?
It'll be very difficult. I joined the staff 43 years ago out of Montreal. I'm a product of Notre-Dame-de-Grâce, Quebec, mm-hmm. originally. Thought I'd come up for 2 years. Wound up staying 43 years and counting because it's such an interesting territory, and doing something else at this stage is completely foreign. It'll be a huge adjustment should I do something else and not retire.
This news was building for a while. You've known it was coming. When did you first find out? How did that hit you?
Well, there was a small group of local investors negotiating for a possible sale of the paper, mm-hmm. but it never came to fruition in the end. So it was mid last week. The owners informed me what was planned, and then the balance of the staff was informed later in the week. And we ran our sad announcement on Friday saying thank you and farewell type thing.
The Star had announced a new business strategy just at the beginning of the year. So what happened ultimately? Why is it not sustainable?
It's just that there are so many negatives against the industry that the potential investors were willing to make a go of it. But you know how business things go. They just couldn't meet the price that the current owners were asking for. There's a lot of potential here, but of course money talks, and it never came to fruition in the end.
How's the staff handling the news?
It's no secret internally or even out in the community that things were not good. Our full-page ads by local and major businesses were disappearing. Our flyers were gone. Classified ads were 99% eliminated. Mm-hmm. Very significant fall-offs in Yukon government and city of Whitehorse advertising lineage. And the other damaging thing, Neil, carriers. People don't think of news carriers, but they were our lifeline to our paid circulation and distribution system. They were absolutely invaluable for us, and of course they disappeared a few years back. And the disintegration of that, distribution system was very, very detrimental to our cause, because if someone doesn't happen to go into a store for the couple of days your average issue sat in the newsstands, you don't sell that issue.
It's one of the last independent newspapers there. What do you think that's going to mean for telling stories in the community?
Well, Whitehorse is about 32,000 people, and it's very fortunate to have several radio stations and still three more newspapers, smaller newspapers, to bring people the news. The thing that the whole tragedy of this is, I think, is the historic nature of the Star. It was one of the oldest businesses in the territory, 124 years. Believe it or not, Neil, it began in a tent in Bennett, B.C. in 1899. And then the White Pass Railway was put through from Skagway, Alaska, to Whitehorse. And the owners of the time thought it made much more sense to come to Whitehorse. And we've been here ever since. But there have been some amazing stories over those decades. Yeah.
Which ones do you think the paper, the Whitehorse Star, will be remembered for?
Well, there was the famous Helen Klaibman story. She and her pilot in a small plane crashed near Watson Lake, southeast Yukon, in 1963. And were stranded in the wilderness for 49 days, and they were found alive, believe it or not. That made Life magazine with Whitehorse Star photos. Robert F. Kennedy, in 1965, he came here to scale Mount Kennedy, which had been named after his slain brother John. Once again, the Star got those photos, exclusive photos, and they made Life magazine. Just so many amazing stories. In June of 1991, we were almost wiped out by a forest fire. Only a change in the wind saved the city. Dawson City flooded to incredible extent in 1979. So many historic buildings destroyed.
Story after story. What about ones for you? I mean, you were around for some of those, the later ones certainly. But are there ones that are there ones that stay with you, that you have framed or in a folder that you keep close?
One of my favorite ones was in 1986. That was 2 years before I became editor. Eric Nielsen suddenly resigned as Brian Mulroney's deputy prime minister. And he retreated to his haven in Quiet Lake, Yukon. And he wasn't talking to any levels of media, national, local, nothing. So Mike Hornbrook of CBC Whitehorse at the time and the Star, we chartered a float plane, flew into Quiet Lake, about a half-hour flight from Whitehorse, landed. We got onto his property and started going up the hill to where he was, and suddenly Eric came out on his deck and said, "No, I'm not going to talk to you." And we tried to reason with him for a few minutes, but he would not speak to us, so we finally gave up. And we were retreating to our float plane when Eric suddenly yells out, "Jim, I saw a bear in the area 15 minutes ago, so you better watch it." And I thanked him profusely, sincerely, because I'd known him for years in advance. He was doing me a favor. We got in our float plane safely without being mauled and flew off again. But that sticks in my memory.
I bet it would. Why wouldn't it? Well, you know, you mentioned the other outlets. Are you going to work somewhere else? Is this the start of a new path for you? Or are you going to go back to Quebec?
No, I think I'll stay in the Yukon. Mm-hmm. I own a nice piece of property here. As a matter of fact, last Thursday evening, I laid out a few pages alone in the building for the mm-hmm. Friday edition, then went home and walked to the riverbank, where I have a great view of a wonderful river called the Tikini River, and I just reflected on things. And I said to myself, the river is going to flow on, life will go on, and I'll just have to have a major personal adjustment in life and decide what to do next. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I'll do next yet. It's been too soon to make any firm plans.
Well, that's beautiful, Jim, how you put it. A storyteller always, clearly. Thank you.
Thank you for your interest in the Star, Neil. Nice chatting with you.
Likewise, Jim. Take care.
Jim Butler is the editor of the Whitehorse Star. Its last edition will run on May 17th. We reached him in Whitehorse, Yukon. It's been weeks of prayer, acts of generosity, and fasting, and now Muslim families around the world are preparing for the end of the holy month of Ramadan, when they'll come together to break their fasts and start celebrating the holiday of Eid, which means that it's also time for our annual reading of the short story Karim Means Generous by Canadian writer Asma Hussein. When our story begins, Karim is reeling from the news that Sean, the kid across the hall, has lost his bike after it was crushed by a car, and Karim feels responsible. He convinced Sean to help him out with his paper route. Now here is frequent, as it happens, guest host Ali Hassan reading from Asma Hussein's story.
On Monday morning, just 5 days before Eid, Karim clipped his helmet strap shut and rode his new bike to school. Mom had taken him shopping over the weekend. She'd chosen a sparkly Eid banner and gold balloons at Party City, and Karim had gotten his bike at Canadian Tire. The best part was standing at the store register and finding out that the bike was on sale, so he didn't even have to use the $40 Teta had sent him. Karim planned to go back to the store after school to buy a new helmet. His old one was scuffed and didn't match the shiny new bike. Just as Karim had anticipated, the ride to school was as smooth as butter. A cool breeze hit his face and hugged the back of his neck. This is the life. "Good morning, class," Mrs. Waters chirped at the start of first period. Halfway through attendance, the door creaked open, and Sean crept into the room. He quickly slid into the seat right in front of Karim. Sean's shoelaces were undone, and the back of his neck was coated with beads of sweat. He must have been running. "Is he late because of his paper route?" Karim wondered. When the period two bell rang, Mrs. Waters stopped in front of Sean's desk. "Sean, I know you're still a bit new here, but I expect my students to be on time." Sean nodded. "Sorry, I'll try my best to get here earlier." Karim watched Sean fiddle with his pencil case as they waited for the math teacher. Karim poked him. "Hey, Sean." Sean turned. "Oh, hey, Karim. Did you miss the bus?" "No, they added 5 new houses to my paper route. I kind of miscalculated how long it would take to get around without a bike." "Oh yeah, that must have been hard." "Just say it already. You'll feel better." "I'm sorry. I should have finished the paper route for you that day." "It's not your fault," Sean shrugged. "I think it was just bad luck. If I leave home half an hour earlier, I can deliver the newspapers and get to school on time." Karim was shocked. "Half an hour earlier? But you already leave home before sunrise." "It's temporary," Sean replied. "I'm saving for a new bike. I should be able to get one in a few weeks." The math teacher walked in before Karim could say anything more. What would he have said anyway? Sean looked exhausted, and there was nothing Karim could do about it. At the end of the day, Karim zipped open his backpack in front of his locker. Something purple slipped out of his bag and landed on the ground. Teta's Eid Mubarak card. "Is this card haunting me?" "No, it probably just got stuck in one of my notebooks." Karim opened and reread it. "Did you know your name means generous?" He angrily shoved the card back into his bag. "I know what my name means, but it's too late now. I'm buying my helmet." Karim got onto his bike and rode until he was in front of Canadian Tire. He ran to the back of the store and scanned the helmets hanging on the racks. He picked one up and admired its sleek black and red stripes. It looked perfect, but it felt heavier than normal. Too heavy. Helmet in hand, Karim wandered through the aisles for a while until he reached the sports equipment section and noticed a big red sign that read "Clearance." Karim rifled through some of the knick-knacks on the shelf, and then he noticed a box pushed all the way to the back. The man on the box was riding a bicycle with a large basket hooked onto the front of it. The basket was full of groceries, a bouquet of flowers, and a tiny dog. A shiver ran up Karim's spine. He stared at the box for a few seconds. This delivery basket would be perfect for Sean if he had a bike. He stared longingly at the shiny new helmet in one hand and the delivery basket in the other. He could only afford one. Karim stood at Sean's door at 5:15 the next morning. He was about to knock again when he heard shuffling coming from inside. Sean swung the door open. His hair was messy, and his eyes looked heavy and tired. He was wearing only one shoe. Hi, Karim stammered. "Sorry for knocking so early, but I figured you'd be awake." Hi, Sean replied, stifling a massive yawn. What's up? He bent down to put his other shoe on. You can borrow my bike for your paper route, Kareem blurted. I hung a big delivery basket on the front for the newspapers. Sean's mouth hung open. Wow, he said slowly. I mean, that's really generous of you, but don't you ride your bike to school? Yeah, but I planned the whole thing out already, Kareem said. You'll take my bike in the morning for your paper route, then ride it straight to school and lock it up outside, and then after school, I'll pick it up and ride it home. Easy. Sean nodded. Yeah, but how are you getting to school in the morning? Bus, Kareem said. He suppressed a shudder at the word. He hated taking the bus, but he couldn't stand the thought of Sean waking up in the dead of night like this. On Friday afternoon, Kareem arrived home from school to find Mom hanging up the Eid banner with the phone perched between her shoulder and her ear. I'm your only grandson, he laughed. Detta liked using that joke a lot. Eid is tomorrow, Mom said, throwing her arms around Kareem and squeezing tight. Oh, and Detta's on the phone for you. Assalamu alaikum, Detta. Eid Mubarak, Kareem grinned into the receiver. Walaikum assalam, Kareem. How's my favorite grandson? Alhamdulillah, Teta. How are you? They chatted for a while about what they were each going to do for Eid. Then he told her about buying the delivery basket and letting Sean use his bike for the paper route. I've been taking the bus in the morning, Kareem explained. It's annoying and slower than my bike, but at least Sean is always on time for first period now. Well, I never thought my note would lead you on to such an adventure, Teta said. The name Kareem suits you. Thanks, Teta, he blushed. You know, Teta continued, when you've gotten old like me, you realize the things you give away make you happier than the things you keep for yourself. That made sense. Even though Kareem had worked all Ramadan to save up for his bike, he was actually kind of glad to be sharing it with Sean. Weird. I have to hang up now, Habibi, Teta said. I don't want to burn my Eid basbousa. But I want to tell you something else before I forget. What is it, Teta? He asked. Anytime you share something you love, it comes right back to you, like a boomerang. You never lose it. Just wait and see. On Eid morning, the apartment smelt like butter, cinnamon, and coconut. No more fasting. As Kareem put on his white thobe for Eid prayer, he heard a loud rapping at the door. FedEx delivery, a man called from the outside. It's for me, Dad said, answering the door. Wow, this is a huge box. Dad ripped open the note inside. Dear Mr. Nasir, thanks for your fantastic work on the ad campaign. We look forward to working with you again. Enjoy this gift. Yours truly, Outstride Limited. Shall we open it and see what's inside? Yeah, Kareem yelled. Dad used kitchen scissors to slice open the layers of tape on the box before pulling out some styrofoam padding. Dad scratched his head. It's a bike. Dad, Kareem said, this isn't just any bike. This is a Super Speedster X bike. It's exactly like the one I just bought. Like, exactly. It's even the same color. Well, that's a strange coincidence, said Dad. Anyway, I already have a great bike in storage. Since you inspired my design idea, the bike is yours. There's no way this is a coincidence. This must be the boomerang Teta told me about, an Eid boomerang. Kareem looked at the bike sitting in the middle of the living room. He immediately knew what he was going to do. After Eid prayer, Kareem knocked on Sean's door. Hey, Kareem, Sean said, yanking the door open. Wait, I know what to say. Eid Mubarak, he read off his palm. Ha, thanks, Kareem replied. Eid Mubarak. Hey, do you want to go on a bike ride with me? I know I'm skinny, said Sean, but I'm not sitting in the delivery basket. Kareem burst out laughing. He grabbed Sean's arm and pulled him into the hallway. Two identical shiny bikes stood there, waiting to be ridden. What? Where did you get? I don't understand. What's happening? It's a long story, and I'll explain it all. But first, get your helmet and let's ride. The boys walked toward the elevator. A week ago, they had awkwardly stood in this same spot to go on Sean's first paper route. "This has honestly been the weirdest week of my life," said Sean, mounting his new bike outside their building. "Same here," Kareem replied, "but a good kind of weird." They both grinned. As he rode next to his new friend, Kareem felt the cool breeze whoosh against his face. Teta's words echoed in his mind. "Anytime you share something you love, it comes right back to you." He believed it.
The most recent data we have on HIV infection rates in Canada are alarming. Public Health Canada says HIV infections went up by 25% in 2022 alone, which makes it all the more troubling that last week federal funding for self-administered HIV testing kits dried up. Sean Rourke has been leading efforts to get federal approval for the take-home tests and to make them available across the country. He's the director of the MAP Center for Urban Health Solutions at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. We reached him there.
Sean, you were a big part of making these tests available to Canadians. This was a big win for you and others who you worked with. What will it mean for these tests to not be available now?
It's terrible. It's we're reaching people who need to get tested and know their status. So they, if they're positive, get connected to treatment and care and the latest medicines that they need. Mm-hmm. And so this is terrible that we won't be able to do that anymore.
So you're saying the tests that people could get through their doctor's office or go to a clinic to get tested, those avenues are not reaching enough people?
So they work probably for 90% of the population, right? But some people, you know, just feel that they've had a bad experience in a clinic or a hospital or they don't have a doctor. There was one story that somebody told me. But a young girl who came to the clinic to get STI testing, but just terrified that she might have HIV. And when she came to see the nurse, she decided, well, I don't want to test for HIV. And so she left, and she called a few days later and said, can I get one of these self-tests, these HIV self-testing kits? I said, sure. And just called back, said, you know, I was so relieved that I could do this at home in my own environment. I was feeling safe there. I was relieved. I was so thankful. And the person helped them walk through it. So not everybody connects with the system. And this is a way to meet people where they are when they're not going to connect into our healthcare system.
Health Canada has said there was always a time limit on this $8 million investment in this program, and that it is just one part of their wider program to support HIV testing. So they're saying you knew that it was limited. And that the money would stop flowing at some point. So how do you respond to their reassertion of that?
Well, I mean, it's a good position to start with, but it was wonderful, you know, on August the 1st of 2022 in Montreal at the International AIDS Conference, our health minister, Minister Duclos, announced $8 million. And we got busy right away, set up a distribution system for it. And through that year, we started to work on this, and then the government of Canada continued it for this past fiscal year up until March 31st. But yes, so they said that, but they haven't put in place the mechanism and the relationship with other provinces to take over.
Was that a clause in your initial deal with the Health Canada that they would help build bridges with the provinces?
Well, I think that yes. I mean, that was part of the plan. Mm-hmm. But it's more just this is what we'll need to do. Yeah. And I can tell you there's other tests that are in the marketplace now for HIV and syphilis that are not being picked up either from the federal government or the provincial government. So it was said, but nothing was put in place, and they should continue it until we get there. And that's, in fact, what needs to happen, I think, in the longer term.
The statistic that our listeners heard in the introduction that HIV infection rates went up by 25% in a single year, that was what came out of Public Health Canada in 2022. What is behind that rise?
So part of that is what we're seeing from COVID, that things dropped out, right? Like there was 30 or 40% of people that weren't getting tested. We're seeing some increases there. And you point out to 2022, that's not 2024. Like, we got to do a much better job in having data in data in real time, because we can do that if we really invest properly. But the numbers are up because of COVID, but they're also up because there's a lot of things that have in our health and public health system that have not been funded adequately for many, many years, including the community-based sector, right? So it's been degrading for a while now, and we're now just seeing it just can't bear the brunt anymore. And the numbers are going up, and the numbers in 2023 and 2024 are going to be even higher in some of these places because we haven't responded. We learned a lot of lessons, as you know, in COVID about how do you reach people and support them, but we haven't translated that into other health conditions like HIV and syphilis and other ones. We need to, learn from those experiences and build back a system in a way that's going to meet people where they are and address these complex health circumstances.
Beyond the impact that COVID had, are people just forgetting the real threat of HIV? You know, certainly no one thinks it went away, but to see that there's been an increase and could be a further increase, what has happened?
Well, I think, in Canada, we're pretty shy, right? We don't do a very good job with talking about sexual health in general. And so we need to have those conversations with everyone. We're seeing new infections up in younger people and older people as well. So the education needs to be there. We need to be much more upfront. This is part of just being human, right? So I think we've not done a good job with education and awareness, and we need to do better with that. But we also have to address the other barriers. There's still racism in the healthcare system. There still is homophobia. There still is, the residential school system. These are all factors that prevent people from not getting tested and not talking about the importance of things like HIV, right? And having avenues for people that work for them to get tested and treated and connected into care. So there are broader societal issues. And again, coming back to COVID, we've learned a lot. We now use the word health inequity or health equity, right? And people know about what that means, or health disparities. And I think people are, recognizing that there's certain populations that we're just failing. We know that we have the data. Let's just fix it for once, because this program worked. It's a huge success story. I'm hopeful, just about it. I'm very, very optimistic that, and the world is watching, right, that we're doing this and that we're doing it well. We don't want to stop something that's actually helping save lives.
Sean, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sean Rourke is the director of the MAP Center for Urban Health Solutions at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. North Americans are getting the chance to marvel at a rare, once-in-a-lifetime natural phenomenon. But they're also being warned not to look directly at it, because it's kind of disturbing and gross. The coming weeks are expected to bring an extremely rare dual emergence of cicadas. The Great Southern Brood and the Northern Illinois Brood, which are adjacent to each other, as you probably know, are set to co-emerge. The last time that happened was in 1803. Floyd Shockley is an entomologist and collections manager at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. We reached him in D.C.
Floyd, there are a lot of phrases being thrown around to describe what is about to happen. One expert called it cicada-geddon. My favorite might be what Jonathan Larson from the University of Kentucky told NPR. Quote, this big, spectacular, macabre Mardi Gras, it's a lot of singing, lots of paramours pairing up, and then lots of dying, unquote. Does that sound about right to you?
Well, I certainly think the second one is more how I would describe it than the former. It's going to be a spectacle one way or another.
Yeah, it does sound like quite a party. But the cicada-geddon part of it hints at, how some people feel about bugs. And maybe they're not as excited as you are for what is about to happen. Do you think cicadas get a bad rap?
Oh, I definitely think they get a bad rap. They're scary to a lot of people because they don't have, they're big, for one. But, you know, the fact that these guys come out in such large numbers, overwhelming numbers, I think can be a little overwhelming to folks who aren't of the entomological community like me. So yeah, it can definitely be scary, especially if you have a natural aversion or are afraid of bugs. You know, there's millions to billions of them, you know, an inch or more in length. So I can certainly see how people would be scared of them.
Yeah, I don't love all bugs, but cicadas, they don't freak me out. And I actually like their sound generally. But what would you say to people who are in the other category and might be scared by this, how to put it into perspective in their mind?
Well, for one, they're very gentle. They don't bite. They don't harm plants.
They're lovers, not fighters.
Well, that's right. You know, they've spent their entire life, almost 99.9% of their life, underground, completely not causing anybody any problem. It's just this last stage. They've got to come out. They've got to find a mate. They've got to lay eggs and then die. And they do that all very quickly. But they're not going to really be anything more than potentially a nuisance in areas with really high densities of the cicadas. And it's only the males that are singing, by the way. So it's a male chorus all going off all at once with one purpose: to woo the ladies.
You've described what it's going to look like, or how many of these cicadas are going to be out there. How would you illustrate it to people? What is it going to look like in the states that are affected?
Well, it won't be very hard to miss the cicadas. They're going to be in areas where there's a really high density. You're going to be finding them hanging out low near the ground first thing in the morning. And then in afternoon, after they've warmed up, they're all going to start flying around looking for a really great perch to start singing from. And so, you know, there will be many of these flying. When we had brood 10 here in the Washington, D.C. area, you know, when you were driving along the Beltway, you know, they were pinging off of your windshield like you were driving through a hailstorm. There were so many of them in certain parts of our region, and it'll be very similar to that in especially parts of the Midwest, where both broods that are emerging this year are going to be out and active at the same time.
Yeah, one of the broods comes out every 17 years, the other every 13 years. The last time they lined up, Thomas Jefferson was president. You've described this as a cicada train that would reach to the moon and back 33 times.
That's right. In this particular emergence, there's easily going to be over the entire period, starting actually in just a few weeks, until into early July, there's going to be over a trillion cicadas. And if you consider that they're each about an inch long and you start to do the math, it doesn't take very much time to get a really long thing. So literally, it would go, if you lined them all end to end, all the way to the moon and back, more than 30 times.
Will the broods emerge at the same time? Are they going to cross at all?
So there will be a period of time that they are both out, but they don't all come out all at once. And the reason for that is, in the year of emergence, the cicadas use soil temperature as their cue to emerge. So they're waiting down in the ground. Even right now, they are waiting 12 to 18 inches below the surface for that soil temperature to hit 64 degrees Fahrenheit. And when that happens, that is the cue for them to start digging their way up to the surface. And of course, that's going to happen first in the southeastern U.S., right? The southern states are going to warm up faster. And then as we get further into May and into June, that's going to start to sweep up through the middle part of the eastern U.S. And then finally, those in the northernmost states in brood 13, which is the 17-year cicadas, mm-hmm, will finally be at the last. But there will be a period of time in May in June, where there will be brood 19, which is the 13-year cicadas, and brood 13, which is the 17-year cicadas, will be out at the same time.
Do you have a big dual emergence road trip planned?
Oh, definitely, yeah. So my plan is to definitely be in middle Illinois in late May, early June, because that's when both broods will be active simultaneously. And so literally just a few miles away from one another, you'd be able to collect all seven species. You'd be able to hear all seven species singing their individual songs in just a short distance. And so it's a really exciting opportunity, and it's one that many of us won't ever get to see again.
You know, we've been talking so much about the eclipse. Do you even care? I mean, do you think people are missing the really exciting thing that's going to happen this summer?
Oh, well, you know, I think a solar eclipse is is absolutely a cool event, right? but it's actually in a much smaller area than the cicadas are going to cover, so that's one. And two, you know, we have solar eclipses actually more frequently on Earth than these dual emergences. So this is an even rarer event than the solar eclipse.
It sounds like that's the entomologist version of trash talk. Like, this eclipse is not as rare as our cicadas.
Well, I mean, that's true. But, you know, what can you say? They're both really amazing things. And it's great that, you know, folks here in the eastern U.S. Yeah. are going to get a chance to experience both.
I'm glad we could speak, Floyd. Thank you.
Thank you again for having me.
Floyd Shockley is an entomologist and collections manager at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. We reached him in D.C. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.